Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Review of Film and Video, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, Robin Hood Radio's very own critic. He joins us weekly. The Films, Cry Macho, The Eyes of Tammy Faye, and The Mad Woman's Ball. I approve. I'd like to be this week's namer. I think that they're all compelling titles. How are these movies?
Yeah, you know, I guess they are. You know, they're all pretty good titles, yeah. One of which is not really original. The Eyes of Tammy Faye is borrowed from a previous film, but we'll get to that in a moment. I'd like to start out by talking a little bit about Cry Macho, and Cry Macho is the latest movie, both directed by and starring the unstoppable Clint Eastwood. The guy is 91. And here it is. He not only is still acting, but he is even still directing, and he has now made this movie called Cry Macho, which will sound to people like a typical Clint Eastwood title. I mean, here is the guy who became really famous playing the so-called man with no name in movies like A Fistful of Dollars and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly about a jillion years ago, and Dirty Harry to way back then. Obviously, a guy of whom macho was a very large part in his personality. Very macho guy. But what's interesting is that in recent years, old Clint has been trying to sort of correct that macho image of his by making movies that show, shall we say, a kinder, gentler Clint in certain ways. And probably the most interesting incident of this, again, among his past few films, was his movie Gran Torino, where he makes this movie where the whole thing is building up to what we're expecting to be, and this is several years ago now, so this is not really a spoiler on this movie, but the whole thing builds up to what we expect to be a great Dirty Harry type vengeance, violence, gunplay conclusion. And although the conclusion, the climax, does turn out to involve violence and gunplay, it turns out to be the direct opposite sort of message from the old Dirty Harry movies. It's a message sort of saying, isn't it too bad that things like this happen? So Clint has been trying to moderate and modify his image in recent years, and that project continues in Cry Macho, where despite that title, Cry Macho, we have here again quite a sweet Clint in a lot of ways. So here's what the movie's about. Clint plays a guy whose name is Mike Milo, and he was once upon a time a successful rodeo guy, and he rode bucking broncos and broke horses and did all these things that you do when you're a macho cowboy and all of that. But along the way, in one of his rodeo appearances, he broke his back, and ever since then he gets around, but ever since then he's had to really lead a much more quiet career, and now he is an old man like the real life Clint Eastwood. So what happens at the beginning of the movie is that an old friend of his asks him to do a favor and kind of calls upon him and demands that he do this favor. You owe me, Mike, you owe me. So Mike decides to do this little favor, which involves going down to Mexico, finding the gone wrong teenage son of the old friend, and bringing that son back up to Texas from Mexico. The son is now living with his mother, who turns out to be a very feisty woman and not a very nice woman, and she and Clint's old friend are separated from each other, and that's why the old friend wants to get this boy away from his mother and back up into the United States, but the boy himself is really a handful. So at the beginning of the movie, pretty much, Mike Milo, played by Clint Eastwood, goes down to Mexico, finds the troublesome boy, and the whole rest of the movie is their journey through parts of Mexico and then coming back to the United States. And, yep, they are being tracked by people working for the mother who don't want the boy to get away. And also the law gets after them for a little while. So, they have various adventures here and there along the way. Macho is the name of a rooster that belongs to the boy. That's all it is. The boy is, as I said, he's sort of gone down a wrong path in life, and he's involved in cockfighting, and Macho is the name of his rooster, the name of his cock, and he accompanies them on the journey. So it's basically the story of an old man, a teenage boy, and a rooster making their way from Mexico to the United States. So now the big question becomes, is Cry Macho a good movie? Oh, it's okay, I would say. It's beautifully photographed. It looks really, really nice, and I'm sure the cinematographer gets all the credit for that. Clint directs it in his usual style. It's his usual sort of late career style. It's very sort of laid back. There's no showy stuff in it, whatever. It's just sort of a mild-mannered, he plays a mild-mannered character and a mild-mannered Western. So the best thing about Cry Macho is that it looks really nice. It just has a lot of beautiful images in it, and it's reasonably well acted. It's also preposterous. I mean, not only does 91-year-old Clint Eastwood have a scene where he rides a bucking bronco, obviously with a stunt double doing the real work, but like women are coming on to this guy. Okay, nothing against that. But, you know, hey, the guy is 91, and it's a little bit inexplicable as to why these women seem to find him irresistible. But there you have it. So it's the old Clint doing the old things in a slightly new way, and I just mainly think it's marvelous that the old boy is still out there writing and directing movies. I want to take a moment, Jill, to plug my book, The Cinema of Clint Eastwood, Chronicles of America. It came out a few years ago, so it obviously does not include Cry Macho, but I'm just so glad that the guy is still carrying on, and who knows how many more movies he may have in him before he meets his maker, I hope many, many years from now. Moving to our second film, which is really different, The Eyes of Tammy Faye. And if that title sounds slightly familiar to some people, it's because way back 21 years ago, in the year 2000, a couple of filmmakers named Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato made a movie called The Eyes of Tammy Faye, and that was a documentary about Tammy Faye Baker and her husband, Jim Baker, the really, really famous televangelists of yore. And The Eyes of Tammy Faye is even in the credits of the movie. It is based very directly on that documentary. It is just sort of a slightly fictionalized version of all the things that were related in that documentary. And the new movie is directed by Michael Showalter. And what we have here are a couple of really good actors. We have Jessica Chastain, who is playing Tammy Faye Baker, and Andrew Garfield, who is playing Jim Baker. And I must say, I reviewed the documentary recently, and so I had a lot of good look at the real-life Tammy Faye Baker and Jim Baker in the documentary. And I have to say that Jessica Chastain and Andrew Garfield do a really good job of looking and sounding and behaving pretty much like those real-life televangelists. It's not only impersonation, though. Their performances are very good on sort of an interpretive, psychological level, at the same time that they are very good as just impersonations of those very famous figures. Of course, for a lot of people nowadays, Tammy Faye Baker and Jim Baker will be just names that don't mean much of anything. But I remember when they were all over the place. Again, they were really, really famous televangelists. And so the movie, The Eyes of Tammy Faye, is very much about their rise. And unlike the documentary, it's the actors playing the parts. But unlike the documentary, it shows them as very young people, first sort of discovering Jesus and then getting into the evangelistic realm. Tammy Faye Baker, because she wants to be a singer. Jim Baker, because he wants to be a preacher, and when they get together and they get married, of course, she does her singing as part of their evangelist and then televangelist act, and he does his preaching, and they rise and rise and rise and become enormously powerful household name figures in America, earning jillions of dollars and mostly by putting their phone number on the bottom of the TV screen during their televangelist shows and having people send in contributions. And they use that money in some legitimate ways, that is to say, preaching the gospel in which they firmly believe, and some very illegitimate ways, such as using money that they haven't really gotten yet to embark on huge projects like this theme park, this evangelistic theme park that they built, and then they couldn't pay the bills, and they were getting money under false pretenses, and they were this and that, and all these bad things that people sometimes do. Eventually, and this is, again, all on the historical record, and at the time that it happened, it was really, really famous. Jim Baker was sentenced to jillions of years in prison for all of this chicanery that he was involved in. Tammy Faye Baker escaped that fate, but she her career as a singer was, let's say, severely interrupted. And eventually she found her way back to some little measure of fame and fortune, but living a much diminished version of her former life. So again, the movie The Eyes of Tammy Faye has these two terrific actors playing the real-life figures, Tammy Faye Baker and Jim Baker, and it shows their rise, and it shows also, for me most fascinatingly, their interaction with other really, really, really famous TV preachers. Pat Robertson, who's still around with his show, The 700 Club, and he was a sort of mentor to them for a while and helped them to rise in the early days of their televangelism career. And then the infamous Jerry Falwell, who was the big starter of the whole moral majority thing, and who was a person who really made evangelism and especially televangelism really, really political in a very, very conspicuous right-wing way. And he turned out to be somebody who, according to the documentary and this new movie, really betrayed them and did horrible things to them and was largely responsible for some of the horrible things that befell them when their careers suddenly plummeted. So he is another figure in this movie, and he is also very, very well acted by Vincent D'Onofrio. His performance as Jerry Falwell is a real high point of this movie. So I really had a good time looking at the Eyes of Tammy Faye. Again, I admire the documentary, and it's still around. You can easily find it streaming, and I would advise looking at that if you're interested in this subject. The new fictionalized version, not all critics are really crazy about it, and I'm not crazy about it, but I just thought it was really, really well done. And Jessica Chastain especially is just wonderful, playing this woman who was almost a caricature of herself with her huge eyelashes and stuff like that. And Andrew Garfield has a nice time, too, playing Jim Baker, the poor guy, just met such an unhappy fate. And anyway, when I say I enjoyed the movie, it's not always a cheerful movie, but it's a really interesting account of a real-life a couple who had a big impact on American culture for a while. And I just found it a very interesting and engaging movie. And our final film this week, Jill, The Mad Women's Ball, is again a very different sort of a kettle of stuff. Here we have a French movie directed by Mélanie Laurent. And Mélanie Laurent is an interesting figure. She is both an actor and a filmmaker. And her most recent acting gig before this was in a movie called science fiction movie called Oxygen, which is pretty much a one-person science fiction film where she plays somebody who suddenly finds herself in the middle of nowhere. In this, it turns out to be a spacecraft where she's running out of air, and what's going to happen to her? And there's nobody else even around who can help her out. She's all alone. So she, Mélanie Laurent pretty much carries that movie all by herself. It's an impressive achievement. Just a few months ago, science fiction movie, and she also acts in her own new movie, Le Bal des Folles, The Mad Women's Ball. But she also is the director of it, and she turns out to be a good director. It's not her first movie as a director. I shouldn't say she turns out to be, but she is a good director, and it's a very, very well made movie, and it's on what I found a very interesting subject. So the main character, played by Lou Delage, is a young woman named Eugenie, and she seems to be in contact with spirits of the dead. She gets messages from them. Sometimes they appear to be in the room with her. We can't see them, but she can hear them and get messages from them, and apparently they are authentic. But her family, who are a very wealthy family, are hugely embarrassed by this, and in order to get her to stop having these visitations, or at least to stop embarrassing them in front of their friends, they have her committed to the infamous asylum, La Salpêtrière in Paris. Now, this is a fascinating thing, because La Salpêtrière is a real place, and it was a real place in the late 19th century when this movie happens. And in fact, shortly before the time of this movie, Sigmund Freud had studied there for several months, and it had a huge influence on him. So that is the big, what they used to call, insane asylum, where our main character, Eugenie, is committed by her family. And there she is, as used to happen with 19th century insane asylums, she is horribly mistreated. The so-called therapies they have, the so-called treatments they have, are really, really, really horrible. We also get to see the very, very famous real-life leader of the place, Jean-Martin Charcot, who was involved with interesting and at the time very advanced techniques like hypnosis, and he took photographs of his patients, and that was a very big deal at the time, and he set up this archive of those, and he was a very advanced scientist in a lot of ways. They're also in the movie, played by the director, Mélanie Laurent, is the head nurse, Geneviève Glaize, and she is a real villain who persecutes our main character, Eugénie, but then turns into a good person who helps our main character, Eugénie. I just found it a fascinating movie. I'm interested in Freud, so I'm interested in this real-life place, La Salpêtrière. I'm interested in the whole idea of how treatments of so-called insanity have evolved and changed over the years, and I found this movie to be just a very compelling portrait of those things, even though it's in a very fictionalized context. The movie is too melodramatic, and especially when we get to the climax of it, it's really over the top, violence and horror and stuff like this. But most of the movie, which is about 2 hours long, I found totally engaging, and it never lost me for a minute, except for a few of those melodramatic moments along the way. So if you're interested in 19th century spiritualism, or interested in 19th century treatments of the mentally ill, or anything in the 19th century, or any of those subjects nowadays, then I really do recommend The Mad Women's Ball. I'm not going to say I had a ball, because it's not that pleasant a movie, but it's beautifully done and beautifully acted, and I certainly found it absorbing from beginning to end. So that is my pretty much varied story this week, Jill.
For which we thank you as ever and always, David Sterrett. Films in Focus, the films Cry Macho, The Eyes of Tammy Faye, and The Mad Women's Ball.